Then there is the N chord at about several times 10 to the 18 electron volts. So this starts to look like a leg, human leg, but and there is a lot of interesting things happening up there where you have interaction of cosmic rays with solar wind, and you also have contribution from the sun. But actually, there are more features in the spectrum, which is called the second knee, at around several times at the 17 electron volts. So it's more like a casualty of some car crash now, not a normal person. What I will discuss today is these very highest energies, ultra energy cosmic rays, which I will generally define as the particles above the end, about several times to 10 to 18 electron volts. And these fluxes are extremely small, these fluxes at these energies. One particle per kilometer squared per century. And and by the way, these are all observed spectra. And in order to infer the accelerating spectra, the initial spectra, you need to fold in this propagation. Now, here is a spectrum which is multiplied by E cubed to make it to bring out the features. And here is the ANCL at several times 10 to the 15 electron volts. Here is kind of second knee. Here is the knee at several times 15. Second knee, and this is the ankle, and that's the foot, the highest end of the toe, the highest energy cosmic rays. That will be our prime interest here. So the composition at low energies, meaning below the knee, we have all. It's pretty kind of straightforward. We have overabundance of rare elements, which are produced by spallation of more energetic particles than when they hit interstellar medium. And things are messy because they have acceleration and so on. What is interesting to me is the composition at the highest energies. And here there is interesting behavior. Below the knee, it's mostly protons. Above the knee, it's becoming dominated by heavy particles. But above the ankle, it becomes protons again. And here is the data from high-res, and the green is the proton ratio. And you can see, here is the ankle is about here. And you start to become dominated by protons. And I guess both experiments, several experiments agree on that. Propagation of high-energy cosmic rays is mostly affected by magnetic field. And that introduces a lot of problems because we do not very well know extragalactic magnetic field. But quantitatively, if a charged particle in a magnetic field, it moves along spiral trajectory. And a typical size of that trajectory, it's called Larmor radius, is say energy in terms of 10 to 21 electron volts divided by magnetic field in terms of in Gauss, and that will give you a number in parsecs. And I understand that you're not astronomers here. For a comparison, just to remember, one parsec is 318 centimeters. Nearest star is one parsec away. Galaxy is about 10 kiloparsecs, and the universe is about 10 to the 10 parsecs. Just for the scale. Now, the typical magnetic field in the galaxy is about microgauss, which means that only particles with energy less than 10 to the 19 or 10 to the 18 electron volts are confined within the galaxy. The Larmor radius is smaller than the size of the galaxy. So then, there should be a separation, meaning the particles below, which is approximately an ankle, are of galactic origin, and the particles above the ankle are extragalactic. And this is kind of consistent with composition change to the one that I just discussed, that the extragalactic are dominated by protons. Okay. Cosmic rays seem to be isotropic. Isotropic all the way to the highest energy. Meaning, the highest cosmic rays is 3 10 to 20 electron volts. 3 10 to 20 electron volts, this is several joules of energy. And as I mentioned in my in the abstract, the linear momentum in such a particle corresponds to a snapshot quantifier. That in one particle, in one proton, there is a microscopic amount of energy and momentum.
Excuse me, what is the cutoff on that isotropy? I cannot read it.
This is only 10 to, above 10 to the 18 electron volts.
10 to the 18, thank you.
In addition to large scale isotropy, there are possible indication of small scale clustering by this Agassiz experiment, meaning there are several doublets and one triple, meaning that from a small patch of a sky of several degrees, there are events that are coming too close to each other, and the chance probability of that is 1%. But this is not confirmed by other experiments, and this is a big question. And also the interpretation of it is not obvious, because on one hand you can be seeing sources, because these are highest energies and extra galactic fields are low and the propagation is almost straight. But on the other hand, if you have isotropic distribution by you introduce magnetic field, that will give you some kind of lensing that may produce such an effect. Yes. The magnetic fields are very important for propagation of cosmic rays. And I will mostly discuss alpha energy cosmic rays, which are extragalactic. And they propagate from cosmological, well, not cosmological, but from distances much larger than the galaxy distance. And magnetic fields affect them, but it's not clear how. And the problem is the following. If you look at distribution of matter, in the nearby universe, it's not homogeneous. There are clumps of matter and there are voids. And very similarly, when people do modeling of magnetic field, they find that magnetic fields are also very maybe compressed. And that introduces following problems, so to say. So you have a source, and which emits cosmic rays, and in the bulk of the volume, the magnetic field is low, so the particle just goes straight to you. But some of such particles may go to this strong region of the magnetic field, make a large degree turn to you, and you will interpret this as two different. You may interpret this as two different sources. Something similar to Levy's light. And actually, such structures are indeed seen in the synchrotron radio emission. So people are looking at planes of into supergalactic planes, and they do indeed see stretches of 10 megaparsec with a fraction of microgauss. And that will be enough to make a turn for a typical energy particle of the order of one radian. Now, the most important feature of the problem of alpha energy cosmic rays is what is called the Chz-K cutoff. And that is the following. Our universe is filled with microwave background with temperature of 2.7 degrees. And protons interact with these photons, and through those resonance they produce pions, and then these pions decay into photons and neutrinos. But the proton loses energy through this interaction. And a typical scale on which, say, 10 to the 20 electron volts cosmic ray will lose energy is tens of megaparsecs. And just I remind you again that the size of the universe is 10 to the 4 megaparsecs. That means that these cosmic rays must be produced locally in our cosmological background at a scale, well, at most less than 100 megaparsecs. By the way, and this may be of interest more of interest to you, this logic assumes the invariance of Lorentz transformation up to Lorentz factor of 10 to the 10, because that's how you go to the rest frame, momentum frame. And there has been some suggestions that this is not true. Now, is GZK a cutoff sim? So this GZK cutoff should get rid of the highest energy cosmic rays. They should lose their energy and pile up at smaller energies at around 10 to the 19 or so. And unfortunately, the data are not clear at the moment. There are two types of the detectors used now. There's Agassan and Ogen. Sorry, there is Hi-Res and Agassan. And Agassan is in blue. It does not see a GZK cutoff. While Hi-Res data are consistent with presence of a GZK cutoff. Two slides about these detectors. There are two types of detectors. And what detectors do, your atmosphere is your telescope. And then you can have your detector. And there are two types of detectors. There are ground detectors that detect the charged particles, the secondaries that the primary produces in the atmosphere. And the best one is of the one that has more exposure is Agassa, the Japanese one. This is not actually Agassa, but I couldn't find the Agassa detector picture. And the second one is when people observe the fluorescent light that this particle emits. And the high res is the best experiment so far. And of course, when the statistics is low, the calibration and systematics problems begin. And right now, there is a revolution going on in this business because Pierre-Auger Observatory is coming online. And this observatory combines two techniques. It has both surface detector and air fluorescence detector. It has extremely advanced control of the parameters of the system, like weather, position, performance, temperature, humidity, aerosol content, and so on. And of course, when both a ground array and stereoscopic, stereoscopic meaning that some showers are seen by two telescopes, so that you can do triangulation on it. And of course, that allows intercalibration of the two techniques. And the energy resolution is pretty good. It's about 50% at the highest energies, at about 10 to 20 electron volts. Very good angle resolution. And now the first results are just been announced. They're very careful in that they have not announced whether they see GZK cutoff or not. They're very careful at this. But what they have announced is there is no extra flux from galactic center, and that's contrary to Agassa and Sugar experiments. Meaning, I'll probably discuss it later. And also, the fraction of photons at highest energy is very small. And both of these are kind of bad for top-down scenario that I will describe later. At the moment, it has coverage approximately equal to Agassa. But as I say, they're very careful and they're not announcing anything. Now, the main thing that, the first thing that will probably come out of Auger is whether they see GZK cutoff or not. And qualitatively, if GZK cutoff is seen, it will most likely be that the sources are astrophysical and they are located homogeneously through the universe. So some of them are too far out, and cosmic ray, highest cosmic rays do not reach us. And that will allow, well, that will be the first major result. And of course, since the propagation is complicated, you need to fold it with magnetic field. But that also could maybe allow you to probe your intergalactic magnetic field. Secondly, if GZT cutoff is not seen, that will qualitatively, again, that will be a very strong argument in terms of unusual physics. And let me discuss now the acceleration. And I will mention what unusual physics is meant by that. Now, the low energy cosmic rays below the knee are generally accepted to be shock accelerated at supernova remnants. And the predicted spectrum is kind of right, the end of E minus 2. And the power of the comparable and so on. So this is a fairly safe bet, except that we haven't yet seen gamma rays coming from decay of pions from supernova remnants. But again, they may be mixed by the gamma rays produced by other mechanisms, by non-thermal acceleration of electrons and so on. And typically, this mechanism cannot accelerate beyond several times to the 14 or several times to the 15 electron volts. There is not enough potential in these sources. Now, what about the ultra-high-energy cosmic rays, the ultimate ones? And first, they have the extragalactic. And there are two types of approaches, which are labeled top-down and bottom-up. And top-down is probably closer to the heart for most of you, which is very exciting, but perhaps unlikely. And the idea is that the cosmic rays are byproducts of a decay of a superheavy particle, X particle. And the mass of that particle should be larger than, say, 10 to the 21 electron volts. Now, the bottom-up is much more mundane and banal, but that is much more likely to occur. This is a kind of proton that accelerated by astrophysical sources, and there is a number of sources that have been proposed. The problem was that so far, all the sources and acceleration mechanism proposed for the high alpha energy cosmic rays are not compelling. And now, a brief discussion of top-down scenarios. So we have some super heavy X particle, and it somehow decays and produces cascade, quark gluon cascade, and these quarks may eventually combine into protons and give you ultra-energy cosmic rays. They are facing a very big problem. So of course, there are many possibilities for this type of particle because we don't know them. There are topological defects and all kind of super heavy particles you can think about. But the problem is that this decay is very likely to produce more, to release more energy in photons and neutrinos than in the cosmic, than in baryons, for example. And the idea is that this cascade, we have quark, gluon cascade, and quarks will be combining more easily into mesons that will decay eventually and release larger fraction of the energy in photons. But these photons that you may start with a photon, say 10 to the 19, they're not 20 electron volts. These photons will initiate electromagnetic cascade through pairs and photons. And all that energy that you released at whatever energies will end up at around GV, at the end of the cascade. But at the GV range, we do have observations. There is an E-grid satellite, which is observing photons in the background in this range. And that this is actually absorbing all the energy that is coming out, from, not all, but a large fraction of the energy that may be coming from this decay of superheavy particles. And that puts a limit on your number density of these superheavy particles. And these limits are pretty tight. For example, the amount of energy in this GV range is about 100 times the total alpha-energy cosmic ray energy. But the alpha-energy cosmic rays, they are local events. While with these photons, they're global, they're coming from a large fraction of the universe. And that puts a very tight constraints on densities and
Sure. I mean, what you just said is certainly true of a lot of top-down models, and certainly the Z-burst mechanism. But there is at least one model which avoids this hybridization.
Yes.
I can tell you later. It's not archived.
Yes. I'm definitely not a specialist in this. As I say, I haven't given any references, but that was more for the educational purpose that though we don't observe this particle directly, but we do have an observational probe of the model. And I'm sure there are ways around, there are tricky ways around.
That's a tricky.
Yeah.
Clever.
Yes. Yes.
Yes.
Yeah. Now, yes. What I will discuss next will be kind of 19th century physics, in the sense that we'll be trying to accelerate protons by electric fields. And that will be mostly exercise in electromagnetism. But I think that's the most. Well, okay. So, just to recap, what do we need to do? These cosmic rays need to be produced locally, within 100 megaparsecs. You need to have sources that have large potential of the order of 10 to the 20 volts. It's very unlikely that you have a source with small potential and the particle goes many times through. You need to explain proton composition. From isotropy, we can estimate how many sources do you need. From isotropy and small-scale clustering of a gas, we may estimate how many sources do you need per GZK sphere. And the answer is several of 10. And the total energy, we don't vary. It's not. Total luminosity is not very important. Now, the astrophysical sources that I will discuss is active galactic nuclei. And just qualitatively, there are two types of active galactic nuclei. And that's a very observer-based classification. There are which are called FR1s with a typical scale of a jet of about 10 kiloparsecs. And the reason that it looks so beautiful is that they're very much more popular, much more abundant than FR2s. So they're low energy beasts, low energy, this jet luminosity. And they're nearby and we can resolve them pretty well. There are other ones which are called FR2s, which are much more powerful. And their jet can extend up to hundreds of kiloparsecs. And a good example is Pictor A. And Pictor A about 10 times further than M87. So on this scale they look the same, but actually this one is 10 times bigger. And in picture A you can see that there is a jet coming out and is depositing some of its energy at a hotspot or radio model. But here you don't see a jet because it's not radiating efficiently. And the total observed radiating power is about 145 Hertz per second. But what will be important for acceleration of alpha-energy cosmic rays is what's the intrinsic power in the jet. meaning the one that is not observed. This the intrinsic power will be generated much larger. And some people that maybe argue that maybe larger by three orders of magnitude, but eventually we'll need energies of the order of 10 to the 45 orbits per second. And there are several possible galaxies with energy that can cut off with such powers.
Max,
yes.
There's so few of the high power sources within 100 megaparsecs, which have already been able to identify more or less one-on-one the existing events.
Yes.
I assume that's not the case.
Yeah. I guess you came a little bit late, and I was just discussing the deflection in the extragalactic or intergalactic magnetic field. May be of the order of unity and may actually produce extra images of your source.
Oh, okay. My understanding was that those fields were too weak, but obviously you're saying something.
Well, especially for you.
Sorry, I'm
yes, that's the one. So you need about 10 megaparsec and 10⁻⁷ Gauss structures. And that such structures I indeed seen. And Phil Kronberg, they're seen in the diffuse signal emission. Now, what are AGMs? AGMs are composed of, there is a central black hole, there is an accretion disk, and this black hole acts something like a Faraday disk, meaning there are large-scale magnetic fields that thread the disk. And basically, it's a conductor with magnetic field, and you rotate the conductor, and that launches an outflow. And so magnetic fields are very important. And magnetic fields, they both launch the outflow and collimate into jets. And also in a jet, magnetic field may be energetically important in the sense that, you know, in a frame of this outflow, B squared may be of the order of Rossi squared. So it's a relativistically strong magnetic field. Of course, the value of this magnetic field may be very low, or maybe, you know, milligauss, but density is very low also. And also at large scales, due to class distribution, you expect them to be dominated by toroidal magnetic fields, by P5. And that would be the, you know, very simple qualitative feature of AGM. Now, what does the acceleration of alpha energy cosmic rays? And a common idea in the field is that the alpha energy cosmic rays are also accelerated by shocks, just like the low energy ones. But there are several problems which people try to bypass or just sweep under the rug, which makes it's not clear if this shock acceleration can be extended to the very high energy. And basically, the problem is that usually the acceleration, you need very high acceleration efficiency, meaning that the particle should gain energy on a scale with Larmor frequency. And that's very hard to achieve. And so far, the models that people do for the alpha energy cosmic rays, they either assume that this indeed happens, or if you do Monte Carlo or Carlo simulation, you put this high scattering rate by hand. All I'm trying to say is that there are other possibilities for highest energy cosmic rays. And also, the spectral break at the ANCL may indicate that a new acceleration mechanism may be at work. And what I will discuss next is a new acceleration mechanism that will turn on specifically only at the highest energies. Okay? And this mechanism will be non-stochastic. By the way, does everyone know what I'm talking about, the acceleration of shocks?
No.
No. Ah, okay. So the idea is, if you have a shock, and you have an inflowing plasma and outflowing plasma, and the outflowing velocity is less, you know, you shocked it. The idea is the following. It's very similar to the following picture. So actually brought a tennis ball or something like that. Suppose I drop a ball, it will be without dissipation, it will be jumping like this. But now what I will do, I will try, I will, with a hand or with a book, I will try to squeeze it. And what will happen? It will do something like that. And if I take out the book, it will jump out higher than before, than I started it with. Okay? The same idea applies, this idea is used in a shock acceleration. And the idea is the following. There is a plasma flow with large velocity and small velocity. So there is a kind of, I can subtract post-shock from pre-shock velocity. And that will, in some frame, you will see the flows converging. Yes? Now, if you can, now, if this converging flows can scatter your particle, then you will get this mechanism of acceleration. And this scattering is usually done by Alfvén waves. Meaning, if there are Alfvén waves, say, well, most importantly, they should be downstream of the shock. A particle goes in, it is scattered by an Alfvén wave, can go, goes in front of the shock again, swept up back, scattered again, swept up back, and that will be very similar to this mechanism that I just described with the ball. So you are between two converging flows, and if you scatter between them, you gain energy on each scatter. And that's called the Fermi 1 mechanism. And as I mentioned, it does work. We do see this happening in interplanetary shocks. And it probably works for low energy half cosmic rays. But for highest energy cosmic rays, there is a problem. And the problem with the highest energy cosmic rays that this scattering should be extremely efficient. You should scatter faster than one on one cyclotron radius, on one cyclotron time. And that's very hard to achieve. Okay? Now, I will do next a very tilde estimates of the possible astrophysical sites for cosmic ray acceleration. And these estimates are very simple and basic. But the problem is that we need to reach such high energies that if we can figure out, with a simple tilde estimates, if we can figure out the possible sites of acceleration, that already will be good. So, acceleration is done by electric field. And typically in astrophysics, your electric field is no larger than magnetic field. So your electric field can be characterized as beta times magnetic field. Then your total potential will be electric field times your size of this accelerator. And your maximum energy will be given by this. You can, express it differently, that the maximum Larmor radius, the maximum circle that a particle makes in a magnetic field, should be this pi to beta times the size of the system. Okay? And now, qualitatively, you can think of two very different acceleration schemes. The one that is employs electric field parallel to magnetic field, just as in an old TV tube. I can't what I know. And the one that is with electric field perpendicular to the magnetic field. And these two possibilities will lead to very different underlying physics. And, and these are based on two paradigms for alternative cosmic ray acceleration. What I will show next is that the first mechanism, in parallel to B, cannot work. And it cannot work for several reasons. So once again, we're looking at negative parallel to magnetic field. And the problem is the following. You want to accelerate a proton. But if you have a negative field parallel to magnetic field, you will also accelerate electron in the other direction. And first, that electron will also see this huge potential difference. But an electron first will very likely make pairs through collision with photons. And the moment you start to make pairs, you will shut off that electric field that accelerates. But there is another problem with this. Suppose you make your region extremely clean of photons, so electrons do not collide with photons. But there is another problem with it. And the problem is that in astrophysics, there is always plasma, meaning there are always charges around. And if you have an electric field, you will drive currents, electron and proton current. And these currents will create magnetic field. No, rotor magnetic field. Sorry. And that magnetic field will cost you energy. Okay? And then you can relate the maximum potential that you can reach to the energy in the system. And that relation is not very good for this mechanism. Even if you take the largest energy possible, 160 Earths in radio and in halos of radio galaxies, the maximum potential is only 10^15 electron volts. Okay? So though this does work in old TV tubes, this doesn't work for alpha energy cosmic rays. What I think may work is when the electric field is perpendicular to the magnetic field. And here we may relate the total potential to luminosity of the system, because when you have electric field perpendicular to the magnetic field, you have pointing flux. That means there is energy flowing out of the system. And you can relate, say, total potential to luminosity. And that is very simple. So your electromagnetic luminosity will be 4 pi r squared, r inside of the system, times pointing flux. And you get electric field is beta times magnetic field, electric potential is electric field times radius, size of the system. And in the end, this is a very important formula expression. If you have a source with luminosity L, the maximum potential, electric potential that this source may have is just square root of L over C. Of course, that assumes that your electromagnetic luminosity is of the order of the total luminosity. Okay? And you may also relate it to the total current in the system, which is also square root of L over C. And that basically relies on resistance in the system as of the order of impedance of free space for pi over C. So, to reach 3×10^20 electron volts, using this formula and beta of the relativity, you need luminosity of the order of 10^46 Hertz per second for protons. And that immediately limits acceleration size to high power anti-galactic nuclei. If you remember, I discussed there are several types. There is FR1, which is low power. There are FR2, which is high power. So low power anti-galactic nuclei cannot accelerate highest energy cosmic rays. And there may be several systems with high enough luminosity within GZK sphere. And that's what I will rely on. Now, acceleration by E perpendicular to B is a bit tricky. Because under usual MHD approximation, if you have a central source, and this is the jet, and there's magnetic field lying on this what is called flat surfaces, say on conical or cylindrical flat surfaces. And so there's a magnetic field, say toroidal field, it's all moving out. And and there's an electric field across these flat surfaces. But the problem is that if you put a particle there, it won't move along the electric field. It will move along the flux surfaces with velocity E cross B. So the problem is that if there is a particle here and there is an electric field with large potential, but it's not easy to access that potential, because to access that potential, the particle should cross my, should move across magnetic field. And it cannot do this because it will try to rotate around magnetic field. And but there are ways actually to do this through what I call kinetic motion across magnetic field. So now we're approaching the core idea of the talk. So if you've been sleeping, you will wake up, and that's the main slide. Oh, there'll be more information here. So here is an idea that actually a philosophical idea that is driving this whole talk and this whole way of research. Suppose we have magnetic field, and suppose there is a shear in the flow. Okay, so let's go to the surface where your plasma is attracted. But since there is a shear, there will be velocity a little bit to the side from here. Now, if you have magnetic field velocity, immediately you find that there is electric field. An electric field, the way I draw it, will be like this. It will be directed away from your point. And now if your velocity is linear with distance, your electric potential will be proportional to minus x squared, meaning that the proton will be at a potential maximum. Okay? And similarly, if you change the direction of magnetic field and do the same exercise, the proton will be at a potential minimum. And actually, what it depends on is this product, B times curl V. So, the point is that, depending on the value of this scalar property, one sign of charge is at potential maximum. Meaning that the moment it starts moving away from this point, it will gain energy. And total potential, the height of this potential is large enough to be accelerated to the outer energy cosmic rays energies. Yes. And again, whenever I talk to particle physicists, they ask me, what's the four vector notation for this B curl V? So that's the four vector Lorentz invariant form. It's electromagnetic energy tensor times velocity, gradient of velocity. Now, in our AGN jets, as I just described, we have toroidal magnetic field, and it's very likely that the AGN jets are sheared, their observational facts in favor of them. So there is a toroidal field, there is a Z velocity, which is shear, and if we zoom it in at some point here, that will be exactly the picture that I just described. Okay? But there is still a problem. The proton is sitting at this huge potential peak, but it cannot just go there because it needs to cross magnetic fields. And to do that, there is still a way for the proton to cross this field. And the things are becoming a bit messy from now on, because what I just described, this idea that the proton is a potential maximum, is a very solid thing. How it moves across the potential, there are several ways, and kinetic motion is one of them. But here is an idea. You have a magnetic field, and have a particle which is gyrating in a magnetic field. If you apply a force to it, it will be something like a Magnus force, meaning that a particle will start drifting in a direction perpendicular to the magnetic field and the direction of the force. And in case of a particle in a jet, if you launch a wave along the jet, and the wave will have a gradient of the magnetic field, let's say at some phase, and this wave will try to push the particle along its propagation. But if it tries to push it along its direction of propagation, and there is a magnetic field, the particle will go in an orthogonal direction, meaning along the potential, along the slope of the potential well. Why can all this be relevant? I guess I will. No. You can calculate what will be the energy gain in this particle, or a particle in such a frame, in that system. And here is the acceleration time, meaning the time for a particle to gain energy equal to its energy. And this is an extremely interesting equation, I have never seen anything. When I saw it, it was quite amazing. First, the acceleration time is inversely proportional to energy, meaning the highest energy particles are accelerated most efficiently. And that's a very weird property. It's, in US, the comparison is this is the Republican rule, meaning the richer become richer. And the richer you are, the faster you become richer. So the highest energy become, highest energy are accelerated most efficiently. Next, the acceleration time is proportional to the charge, meaning the low Z particles are accelerated most efficiently. And this kind of, so highest energy and low Z energy are accelerated most efficiently. And in addition, I will discuss in a minute, the acceleration rate in this scenario does reach the absolute theoretical maximum of 1 over second of frequency. This is not an assumption, in a short acceleration, usually it's an assumption. Here, it's a direct consequence of the mechanism. There is one problem. The problem is that the jets must be cylindrically collimated, otherwise you will lose. Otherwise, your diabetic losses will be important.
I mean, can one understand this acceleration rate just in terms of?
Oh yes,
of derivation, I believe. But, I mean, just in terms of positive process, what is really going on? Why is it inverse proportional to the energy of?
Yes. The theory is the following. The energy gain is proportional to the average, you need to average electric fields times the velocity. But in this case, the velocity that is important is not the gyrational velocity of a particle, but the drift velocity of a particle. So basically, it's drift velocity along electric field. But the drift velocity is increasing with energy. See? If you have a particle with small energy, with a small Larmor circle, it will be drifting slowly. If you have a large Larmor, it will be drifting faster. It's this increase of this drift velocity with energy that gives you this strange property. Yes. I guess I'll skip this. It's getting a little bit too complicated. Now, very interesting things happen at the very last stage. What I've just described is, this drift motion of so this magnetic field. There is a particle that is drifting across the magnetic field, and the picture that I described applies when the Larmor radius of a particle is smaller than your system size. Now, when the Larmor radius becomes large or comparable to the system size, the mechanism changes, and it becomes even more efficient. And it becomes more efficient in the sense that you even don't need to push the particle. And a very simple model we can look at. Suppose we have magnetic field, and you have velocity, shear magnetic field, just as I just described. Magnetic field, and there is a velocity shear. there is this probability, which is V prime, added, which is how linear velocity scales with distance. And in a non-relativistic case, we can solve the motion of a particle in such a system exactly. It's cosine 1 plus eta over omega v. And you can see that if this shear is large enough and negative, the motion becomes unstable. The idea is the following. So we have a magnetic field, and if there is no shear, the particle just makes a circle. Now if we introduce a shear, the trajectory becomes a little bit of an ellipse. And for large enough shear, and the shear, once again, is measured in terms of cyclotron frequency. For large enough shear, the particle just shoots off. Well, there is magnetic field, but the electric field is strong enough that the dynamics of a particle. And for relativistic, you can do similar things. What I'm putting here is the trajectory of a particle in this shear flow, and eta is v prime. And when eta is zero, and this is time, this is x, the displacement. This is just sinusoidal oscillations. When I increase this eta, there is a separatrix that separates orbits that return, the one that just shoot off. So, the basic point is that at highest energies, the acceleration rate does reach absolute theoretical maximum. Okay? In case of this Fermi mechanism, the scattering, when particle long radius becomes large, the particle just leaps, and that's it. There is no more scattering. And that was bad for acceleration. In this case, becoming unconfined is good for acceleration. Now, the spectrum. I'm running out of time. Spectrum becomes harder if you start with some bubble. So this is gamma squared times spectrum. So if you start with some p larger than 1, it becomes one squared. And that's the probability is that's the end goal. So there is mixed composition, but this mechanism picks up the highest energy particles. The highest energy is the low Z particles. That's why all the energy cosmic rays are colorless. Now, your radiative losses are not important, quickly, meaning that this mechanism can operate from about 1 parsec to virtually a megaparsec. So you have all this time of the jet problem, as long as the jet is relativistic. And they can be relativistic for hundreds of kiloparsecs. So this mechanism has a lot of time to operate. Now, as a physical biology, really, and I will wrap it up. You need very powerful AGN. Weak AGNs do not work. And there are several possible AGNs within 100 megaparsecs. And a clear so they're far out. So a clear GZK cutoff should be seen. Now, with such far out sources, you need hard acceleration spectrum. And that's what this mechanism produces. Since it depends on this probability b times curl v, only every other AGN will accelerate protons to highest energies. Interesting, pre-acceleration can be done outside of the jet. So because the particle is at potential maximum, and it doesn't care whether it's going outside or inside. So you can suck the particles in. Main properties. Well, let me close off. And the final point is that this model I expected to be quite well tested within a year with Piaget, because this model relies on few faraway sources, meaning a clear GZK cutoff should be seen. And also, the statistics should be consistent with several accelerating sources. Well, let's wait and see before advancing this idea further down. Further. Thank you.
had some questions already, but we have time for a few more.
So would you predict a directional correlation between the performance upgrades and the AGNs?
Not necessarily, because of this magnetic. So there are several superclusters within the GZK sphere, and what is observed. No, there are direct observations of magnetic, well, a kind of direct observation of magnetic fields within these superclusters. The volume feeding factor is not clear of the magnetic field. There are a lot of unknowns, and this is a big business that people do. And the discussion is now kind of open, meaning it's feasible that a particle, a typical particle, will experience tens of degrees deflection before reaching Earth. So it's feasible, it's not necessary. Some people argue that it should be within several degrees of the source. Some people say, oh, I can easily get 20-30% deflection. But even if it's 20-30% deflection, you can still do the statistics. And you can still say how many sources are there. And the current viewpoint is there should be, you know, the order of several ten sources within the GZK sphere. But with Auger, statistics will be much better in several, in a couple of years.
Okay.
Yes.
Yeah, if you have this microcosmic magnetic field in intergalactic medium, you get practically this multiple images of your sources. I mean, when you do a real experiment, how do you estimate your source properties? Like, what is the real flux a certain source has because of that effect?
Yes, that's a very big problem, because basically your source should be folded with propagation.
Right.
And also propagation affects your spectrum, because the further you wander around, the more energy you lose. This is a very difficult problem, and as I said, there is a business, there's a whole branch of cosmic ray physics that is dealing specifically with these issues. But you're right, it's not straightforward.
Yeah, it looks like a problem which is not solved, which is not solved, right?
Well, people do model, and they explore parameter space, and they come up with the most feasible parameters.
No, but you have a product of two factors essentially, which are unknown, the source and the propagation of the source. And so you can put certain effects either in the propagation or in the source, right?
Yeah. No, it's true that it's very complicated, but there are ways, you know, you can put homogeneous distribution of sources and they will pile up, they produce some. As I said, this is a very complicated and messy business. But you deal with it, yes.
Maybe I can comment. I mean, I'm sure you already know this, but other people may not know. But there are a couple of events which are about 10 to 20 electron volts detected at OJ. I just, in the summer, was in a workshop in Aspen. However, they don't resolve the GZK ambiguity, because they are detected in the ground-based method, but not confirmed by the fluorescence method. So they promise to resolve everything within a year. But these early events, using the AGASA method, they find them. But by the high-res, quasi, Haffner-Park method, they don't find them. So this is a very, I think, for a non-expert, it means there's something that they don't understand about the one or other or both of the detection mechanisms. Because they're the first firm that has both detection mechanisms. Because apparently they're inconsistent.
Yes.
This is very preliminary.
Yes.
But they promise, as you said, within a year, they promise to say if there is a GZK cutoff or not. But at the moment they don't. They have two sets of data. One says there is, and one says there is not. So it's interesting.
Yes. That's so good. Within a year, there should be the breakthrough in our understanding. So, you know, so.
Okay, if there are no more questions, we'll thank you. So Paul, what was your mystery project? You said you had a
lot of writing. Well, you will enjoy that. It's a paper. My collaborator is Peter the mechanism is called the sequestered mechanism.
The limit, whatever you want.